Pod Save America is brought to you by Blinds.com. If you've ever thought about upgrading your window treatments but didn't want the hassle, Blinds.com is here to change the game. They're the only company that lets you shop custom blinds and shades online and then backs it up with professional in-home measure and installation services. Tired of waiting around all day for an in-home design appointment just to get a quote? At Blinds.com, you can skip the stress and get expert design advice through their convenient virtual consultations on your schedule. Whether you know exactly what you want or need a little help deciding, they've got you covered. Do it yourself or sit back and let Blinds.com handle everything from measure to install. Either way, you have access to experts every step of the way. Blinds.com makes it easy to get designer look without the showroom markups. They're on a mission to make custom window treatments easy and affordable for everyone. Get the same quality and service you would get at other high-end stores, but at a fraction of the price. Shop with confidence. All Blinds.com orders are backed by their 100% satisfaction guarantee. If you're not happy, they will make it right. They're breaking the mold, but they're not new to the game. Blinds.com has been around for 29 years and has covered over 25 million windows, making them the number one online retailer of custom window treatments. Right now, Blinds.com is giving our listeners an exclusive $50 off when you spend $500 or more. Just use the code CROOKED at checkout. Limited time offer. Rules and restrictions apply. See Blinds.com for details. Welcome to Pod Save America. I'm Tommy Vietor. I just wrapped up my conversation with Rahm Emanuel, who is Obama's chief of staff. He was the mayor of Chicago. He was a member of Congress for several years, and he was just the ambassador to Japan for Joe Biden. He seems like he's running for president. I asked him about whether he's running for president. You'll hear his answer. It's a little noncommittal, but you know, the vibe suggests he is. We had a ranging conversation. We talked about why he thinks the Democratic Party lost in 2024, how we can fix our brand and put forward a platform that actually wins back the voters we lost to Donald Trump. We also geeked out on some foreign policy. We talked about how Democrats should adjust their policy towards Israel in the wake of the war in Gaza, whether it was right for the Trump administration to bomb Iran. We talked about China. We talked about Rahm's time as ambassador to Japan, and then how, with the benefit of hindsight, he views some of the more controversial kind of Obama-era counterterrorism policies like drones. It was fun to talk to Rahm. It was fun to mix it up. We had to agree to disagree at a bunch of different points, but I think you will find it interesting. And he certainly has a vision and view for where the party should go. And he is hitting the road to make that known. And I think you'll enjoy it. So without further ado, here's Rahm Emanuel. Rahm Emanuel, great to see you.
Nice to see you.
First question.
You haven't aged a bit.
I'm trying. Is me interviewing you as weird for you as it is for me?
It's a little out of body experience that I have to be nice at this point.
Yeah.
I'm
used to staffing you, maybe scurrying away, hiding in the back of a meeting.
Let's just say this. To prepare for this, I had to do about 2 hours of meditation.
Okay, good. I hope it was mindful. All right. So The Atlantic recently ran a big profile of you by a great reporter, Ashley Parker. Yeah. The headline was Rahm Emanuel ... for president? Question mark. That's a question a lot of people are asking. Are you running for president?
I haven't decided. I'm out talking to people, hearing what they have to say, giving some of my ideas on, take a couple subjects as like I recently announced, that I think we should follow Australia and ban social media apps for kids 16 and younger. And I think it's, you know, you're either, when it comes to adolescence, going to have an adult raise a child, or you're going to have an algorithm. And right now the algorithms are winning and parents feel hopeless, helpless in this case. And that has struck a nerve. I have talked about, which is something I care about, and you know this from when I ran for mayor, the reason is we have 2/3 of our kids or 50% of our kids are not reading and doing math at grade level, lowest in 30 years. You know more about the president's position on windmills than you know what he wants to do to fix that. Mm-hmm. And you haven't heard from any governor about calling an emergency meeting. I've laid out a case of what K through 8 should be. Get back to the fundamentals on reading and math, an hour and 15 minutes on the topics, the type of support, but fundamentally reform high school. We in Chicago did, you get a B average, first city, free community college. You earn it with a B average. Second, bring college classes into high school. So kids through dual credit, dual enrollment, advanced placement, international baccalaureate, 50% of the kids in Chicago are graduating with college credit. And then third, you can't earn your high school degree without showing a letter of acceptance on college, community college, a branch of the armed forces, or a vocational ed.
Okay.
Every child will not just walk, but they'll tell you where they're walking to. And we fund, and we got 98% compliance in Chicago. But we have to fundamentally change our education, both reading and math, and what high school is about, so we can give everybody a shot at the future. And then the most important is making the American dream more affordable and accessible. And as I talk about this, if people react the way I think they're reacting to date, and everybody's nice right now, but the rubber hasn't really met the road,
right?
Then I'll do it. If I have something to say that, in a way to say it that I think strikes a chord that I think not only with the public, but I think addresses what I think are the challenges, and I want to talk about later on, having been away from the United States for 3 years, I learned a lot about seeing America from a distance that mm-hmm. I couldn't see right here in the arena. I'll do it.
Just went through the 2006 Obama kind of book tour vibe check campaign swing that I think ultimately got
some
him.
Of us were winning the house back, but yes, that.
You were very busy. You were very busy.
Some of us didn't have time to read that book.
Yeah, pushing okay. around stories about Jack Abramoff and Mark Foley. Deep cuts for the nerds out there. Okay, speaking of presidential campaigns, the DNC has been working on this autopsy report about what happened in 2024. Apparently, they're going to spike that thing and never release it. Curious what you think about that. But more importantly, why do you think we lost in 2024?
Okay. First, to the first part, Tommy, I'm kind of like the middle child, so I'll give a there's kind of two camps here. Let me give you a 2.5 camp here.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't release it now because right now you have the Republicans on the run on healthcare, and I wouldn't divert that. We kicked their butts down in Miami. It was a mayor's race. I was there, and the Republicans are flipped out. I wouldn't change the story. I do think the report has to be public because I think the only way to get right in 2028 is to understand what went wrong in 2024. Those of us like you and I who are addicts about this and want to know the information, and I think it's important, put it out kind of in a slow area, end of the year. Those of us who care will read it and digest it. But right now, the Republicans are scurrying out of Washington, hoping nobody noticed that in a period of the fact that people are worried about health care costs, theirs are going to jack up 20%. Why would you want to change that narrative?
So you're saying, punt it a little bit.
I wouldn't. I wouldn't even punt it. I would do an onside kick.
Okay.
No, but I would move it.
New Year's Day release.
Yeah.
Sure.
And you and I and others will read it and understand it and will grapple with it. But right now, I don't want to take the spotlight off the Republicans. So I'm kind of it's not an either or choice. It's a when choice. That's kind of where I'm at.
Okay.
And my thing is, with the Republicans running in the dark of night out of Washington, nail them, and don't change it. Make sure that by the time they come home and do a couple town halls, all they get is health care.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, number two, in 2024, this is where I'm hoping the meditation kicks in so
okay,
I calm
let's
down.
Okay, let's see how it goes. I want to hear it.
We'll evaluate whether I really did my zen, okay?
Yeah.
So I have kind of three things that I think you have to evaluate. And I do think, contrary to CW, that 2024 was winnable. Even with a 70% country's on the wrong track, not a good candidate, not a good campaign, and clearly not a good message.
You talking pre or post Biden?
I'm talking about, post.
Okay.
Kamala Harris gets the nomination. Biden Harris is down 8. Within a week, because she is change, she goes +3.
Mm-hmm.
And she runs on change and focused on, and her best testing ad is about housing and affordability, et cetera.
Yeah.
All the way through, call it the debate. All the high points, convention, debate, she wins. And also kind of getting the baton and making it her own. Somewhere afterwards, they go from the economy and change, as she is different than Biden and Trump,
mm-hmm.
with a campaign based on democracy as on the ballot, et cetera, to being Biden's continuity in his message. And she goes from +3 to -1.5.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievably, when I find the person that decided it wasn't the economy and change and wanted to go with continuity in Biden, I'm going to kill him.
Wasn't it Joe Biden? I mean, he apparently was like calling her saying, no daylight, kid.
But here's my view. You're your own person.
Right.
And you pay for all this. You spent $3 billion. He didn't tell you to run on his message. Number two, that's one. Two, I think in a core message, and I think this for the party. Now, Tommy, you and I worked together, obviously, with President Obama. I worked also with President Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All three, and this is something the party has to learn for 2028. the three most successful electoral Democrats had to cross a cultural land to get heard on economics. They had to ground themselves in what I call middle-class values. Mm-hmm. We shortchanged it for President Clinton on Sister Souljah. President Obama talks about parenting and fatherhood and then deals with his own pastor, right? Mm-hmm. President Kennedy goes down to Texas and says, I will not be a Catholic president. I will be and take direction from the Pope, but I will be a president who is Catholic. Okay? Everyone, one side note, President Clinton, the number one topic, 40% of his advertising, primary and general, was on, and welfare as we know it, was not on the economy, stupid, was not on the middle class tax cut. And so that is essential terrain. We, in 2024 as a party, get caught up in what I call, you know, bathroom access and locker room access, not on classroom excellence. We get caught up on pronouns. We get caught up on a host of subjects.
But do we get caught up? Because Kamala Harris barely mentioned like trans issues, trans rights in her campaign. Republicans talked about these issues constantly. They ran $50 million worth of ads attacking her. And I think some people would argue, actually, the problem was Democrats didn't fight back and defend and explain our position.
Well, for a lot of reasons, mainly because we allowed constituent groups to dictate message. That is not the people that do it. Yes, they made it an issue, but that's a campaign. Okay? Your job is to make what you want the issue. You have to not only rebut it, you have to turn it. And we did things. It was a recent report on immigration in the early days in the transition for Biden.
Yeah.
And they allowed Washington constituency groups to drive not only policy, but message and then the political consequences. That is also true on a whole host of other cultural subjects. And I'm using culture in a capital
broad
C.
Sense,
yeah. But if you look at the history of successful Democrats, they cross a cultural terrain that gives them a legitimacy to get heard on the rest. Let me take this message or this point just a further. Mm-hmm. In 06, as you know, we kind of modeled first ever using people out of, not using, but recruiting people out of the national security apparatus to run for office. The tactic, believing that messenger was message, was their biography opened up a slew of voters that you'd normally get the mute button on as a Democrat. Mm-hmm. In the same way on presidential, if you don't look like, one, you're grounded where they are in the family room, and two, that you have the strength to take on a member of the family and say you're wrong, Pastor Wright, mm-hmm. Sister Souljah, going on. You can't get heard on the where you want the campaign to be, which is a dichotomy between who we're fighting for and who the Republicans are protecting.
So I hear you.
So that's my analysis of 2024. There's other things to kind of go through, but money wasn't the problem. Usually in campaigns,
money
you
was
got $3 billion.
We had a lot of money.
Okay. The message and how you operated as a campaign, in my view, and I can say this from a distance, in July and August, I was arguing with the campaign from a distance about calling for a national ban on cell phones in classrooms. And I must have made, I was doing it in after hours, but I was making tons of calls to anybody that would answer. Couldn't get anybody to move.
Yeah. I think with the.
And I'm not saying that would have won it, but it would have given you that cultural edge I'm talking about.
I think that's a really interesting point. It's something that hits people directly. I do think, look, I think on immigration, you're right. There was an abject failure to read pretty glaring warning signs, to watch the coverage on Fox News, to see how every day they were focused on the border and it felt like chaos and a crisis and the Biden people didn't move. I do think there's been this emphasis in the wake of 2024 on the suggestion that Democrats ran on trans rights or were constantly talking about the bathroom or were constantly talking about, you know, whatever, or pronouns. And I don't think that's accurate. And I think it leads to the trans community feeling like they were blamed for a loss that I think was about inflation and economic issues others. And I think if I don't want us to miss the point. And I think that was really the real problem.
It's your show, but I just slightly disagree.
You can disagree.
No, here's why. One, you come out, put the clock back a little and look at the video again. We spent 2 years shutting schools down during COVID, much longer than the science actually grounded.
That radicalized.
And people knew it.
Yeah.
And the moment we opened that school door, we blew open the bathroom door. there was debates about bathroom access. There was debate about locker room access. And there was debate about sports. And we were, this is where I disagree, we weren't a party of acceptance. We were a party of advocacy on a set of subjects that weren't core to people. And not that people, as somebody who in 2016, as mayor, dealt with bathroom access, I just didn't make it primary.
Yeah.
But there was, I act like there wasn't heat on these topics, and that we were more than silent, and we went from trying to create an environment of acceptance to one that was advocating for something. And then there are other cultural issues. Don't put them in boxes. How we were permissive on this topic. We were permissive on immigration. We were permissive on a host of other cultural issues that boxed us in a place that took a whole group of voters that we could have won. And they said, look, you look like, you sound like you're from Mars.
Yeah, look, we might have to agree to disagree. Look, you're right. There was heat.
I think we should.
There was heat on this issue, right? I think the right policy approach is basically libertarian, which is like, let people make their own medical decisions. Let families, parents, and kids make their own medical decisions. Get RFK and Dr. Oz the fuck out of, you know, my conversation with my doctor. When it comes to sports, of course, there's questions of sports fairness, but like, it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. Let's let local communities figure that out. But then there's just this question of like of empathy, right? And communities feeling heard. And imagine think back to high school. Like I was a nerdy kid. Sometimes you feel left out. You feel different than others. Imagine you're like a trans kid and you turn on the TV.
You're looking at a guy
and Donald Trump is mocking trans athletes every day at rallies.
And in high school was taking taking ballet in the 70s.
Right.
And there were, trust me, I was the only male in that class.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm about an accepting culture without becoming an advocacy culture. We are going to disagree to disagree because I think you are underestimating how much that became a brand and a profile, knowing full well that the other side was going to use it.
Pod Save America is brought to you by Cook Unity. Festive holiday favorites are available for a limited time and only in select Cook Unity markets, like old-fashioned glazed holiday ham, ultimate holiday turkey dinner, maple whipped sweet potatoes, and their candied yam cake.
Sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
I need that. Some of that.
Love Cook Unity. Bob's Barbecue has a lot of Cook Unity stuff.
Okay.
They've got some pork. They got some chicken. They got a pulled pork sandwich.
Delicious.
That's really good.
Who is this, Bub?
I don't know. I was like, are they here? Are they in LA? Who knows? But anyway, they deliver Cook Unity to me and it's delicious. Cook Unity meals are delivered fully cooked. Just heat up in as little as 5 minutes. Enjoy culinary masterpieces for way less than restaurants or takeout and climbing grocery store prices. Oof, you know. Choose from a rotating seasonal menu of over 300 meals. Or let Cook Unity's platform provide personalized recommendations like apple pie bread pudding, rack of lamb with red wine sauce, roasted turkey sausage dinner, pumpkin spice cake jar, and so much more. Menus are updated weekly and new chefs are always joining the team, so meals will never be boring or repetitive. Cook Unity offers commitment-free subscriptions that start as low as $11 a meal. Skip deliveries, pause, or cancel anytime. Taste comfort and craftsmanship in every bite from the award-winning chefs behind Cook Unity. Go to cookunity.com/crooked or enter code crooked before checkout to get 50% off your first order. That's 50% off your first order by using code crooked or going to cookunity.com/crooked. Hey, Crooked listeners, if you haven't become a friend of the pod yet, you are missing out on exclusive bonus content that drops every single week. If you do join, you're helping us, grow Crooked Media, which is one of the few independent, proudly pro-democracy media companies left in Trump's America. If you join, you also get ad-free episodes of all your favorite pods, ad-free episodes of Pod Save America, Love It or Leave It, Offline, Pod Save the World. You also get bonus content like our new extra episode of Pod Save America called Pod Save America Only Friends, Dan Pfeiffer's Polar Coaster. You also get access to all of our excellent Substack newsletters like Pod Save America Open Tabs and tons more great content. So stop what you're doing right now and go ahead and subscribe at crooked.com/friends. Check it out.
So the harder question, we have a broader Democratic Party brand problem. I think we'd both agree on that. Sketch out for me like the Rahm Emanuel vision for the Democratic Party. How do we fix this challenge we have? Because we're not doing a lot of that right now.
No, well, one is the nominee will, let me back up. The nominee will go a long way that you can't go without a nominee and a primary fight. before that, there's a couple rules about the different, and people conflate 2026 and 2028. 2026 is a referendum election on them. They own the House, the White House, and the Congress. When you have that, like in 2010, 2018, 1994, or 2006, that is a referendum election. Mm-hmm. You have a high turnout about the party out of power. We have seen in every election across the country in the last year exactly that. Independents are going to break 2-1 for the party out of power. We have seen it in every election in every part of the country since November 2024. And there will be a low turnout among Republicans, which we have seen in every election for the last year. That is what this election is about. And like we did in 06, somewhere in the spring, you announce a 6 in 06, you should announce a 6 in 2026, some modicum of a minimum wage, things that we're going to work on, healthcare cost control, things that actually reflect the message of affordability and accessibility mm-hmm. and income growth. I actually think one topic, if I could do a shout out, your groceries are up, housing costs are up, utility rates are up, healthcare costs are up. You know what's not up? People's paycheck.
Yeah.
And we need to, if one person in this state is getting a $1 trillion pay package, how about giving people a minimum wage increase across the country? They haven't had an increase in wages. And with all this technology coming and productivity coming, well, the contract calls for an increase in wages. Absolutely. So if other things are right. So that's a 2026 referendum. 2028 is a choice election. Now, one of my things that I think is a problem for the party is we've allowed Donald Trump to blind us. And what I mean by that is everything we're doing is about, and there's a lot to fight Donald Trump on. He's doing a lot that's damaging to the core of America. But we have to be able to also prove that we can fight for America as much as we are fighting with every fiber and every vigor of our body in fighting Trump. And that centers around, in my core view, both on a message standpoint and in what the brand of the party is, that the American dream, and you and I were talking about our kids earlier before, it's not affordable and it's not accessible to the broad base of America. It's inaccessible. Mm-hmm. And for those of us that over our course of our careers have made it, our kids, one way or another, are going to be okay. But it can't be the American dream when only 10% of the kids of America get access to it. The rules, when people say, I feel like I can't win, there's a reason, because you can't win. It is skewed towards Tommy and Rahm and our families. For our heads, we win, tails, you lose.
Yeah.
And our message and the truth of the matter is, and I think, Tommy, you and I read a lot of history, et cetera, the moment the American dream becomes unaffordable is when our democracy becomes unstable. If you think the system is rigged for your failure, you're going to get pretty angry.
Agreed.
And to the party is about fighting for that home, and the contract is not really hard. Good job, own a home, save for your retirement, save for your kids' education, and be able to afford health care. That is not really a lot to ask for out of a country. And we don't have that. Mm-hmm. Now, we have to be honest. We didn't get here overnight. It was not a Republican fault. It's happened over the last 30 years, each thing incrementally over a period of time. The ladder got pulled up, the door got shut, and double latches were put on. And you can see there's never been a greater concentration of wealth in this country in a period of time, both on home and on the stock market. I mean, the two things that generate wealth, like now. And the idea that the next generation just literally gets handed their entire life's income plus just handed to them. And the tax code encourages you to do it. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And so to me, that's the core. And it would open up to a group of voters over a period of time. And it's not a one election thing. Every day you're doing sweat equity, pushing this. And I think knowing that, as you know, the joke is paranoid people have enemies, the system is not only skewed, you are rather than striving to get into a status, you're struggling to maintain it. And there you are getting the shaft. Mm-hmm. You look, when I left college, I earned less than $20,000 and I was able to get an apartment. Today, my son has worked in the Navy, leaves college. He gets, without going in, much north of what I got, but he gets a housing stipend. And without that housing stipend, his life would be more difficult. A lot of people are making three times what their parents made, and they're stuck in the basement. This is a lived, they're not paranoid. And the next thing is, if mom and dad want to sell the house, the kids come in with the house because they can't get out of there. They can't afford an apartment where I was making a third less than what my own kids, but other kids are making, and I could afford to live on my own, where today kids cannot. They have to have three or four roommates, or they have to live in their parents' basement. This is insane. So that's what I think is the...
I think that's right.
I think that is how you get right with the American people. You make it core to who you are, what you're going to fight about. I think there are other things that if we're strong at home, and I say this going back to what I said about Japan, I learned a lot about Japan, learned a lot about the Indo-Pacific. Being away from America 8,000 miles in 12 hours, I got a chance to learn a lot about America, probably more about America than any other thing. And we have nothing China is doing scares me. It's what we are not doing at home. China doesn't decide whether 50% of our kids can't do reading and math at grade level. China doesn't decide whether we declare war on our research universities while they're racing ahead. Mm-hmm. China doesn't decide whether we don't do all of the above on energy, but only pick oil and gas, and we're going to bet everything on it. There are challenges, other things we have to do, but the things we are not doing at home to take care of the home front is making us weaker both at home and abroad. And it's really becoming at a higher and higher price to us.
I think that is the right message. I think people feel like the system is rigged because mm-hmm. it is rigged. You're hearing it. You're seeing it in polling. You're seeing it in focus groups. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, swing left is knocking on doors. The number one thing they're hearing is not necessarily affordability. It's like the system is broken. It doesn't, you know, burn it all down. And so that leads me to a question. Like, look, I think on paper, it's hard to argue anyone else is better prepared to be president. You've served in Congress. You were a mayor. You were an ambassador. You were the White House chief of staff. Like, literally no other job than White House chief of staff could prepare you to do the job of president, right? But I think politically, you're going to encounter voters who are like, fuck Washington. Burn that place down. Burn what they've done down over the last, you know, 30 years. And they might blame you for NAFTA, our response to the financial crisis in the Obama years, you know, things Congress did. Like, how do you respond to that? How do you deal with that?
A couple of things. One is, you're not wrong about, there's an axis. One way of saying new, which is a bigger kind of call about change, is generational. Young versus old. The other one is strength versus weak, which is a part of the party mm-hmm. brand. And having somebody with strength would be different for the party. Now, as you well know, when it came to taking on the financial industry, who got the call and who got the ball? When it came to taking on the insurance companies for kids' healthcare, who got the call, who got the ball? Who was the first municipality to sue the pharmaceutical industry over opiates? Who has had the toughest regulations as it relates to tobacco and kids? Who took on the national gun lobby? So strength would be a whole new quality to the Democratic Party. And second is, as it relates to the financial industry, I would just say some of us were advocating for Old Testament justice. I don't want to relitigate
this. I recall.
Okay. Some of us said...
I wish you had won that fight.
Okay. Well, actually, this is a good lesson. And I just did this yesterday with a bunch of high school kids in Vegas.
Old Testament justice?
Well, no, in the sense of, you know, the president... In the Oval Office, there are two choices, bad and worse.
Right.
There's never good and bad.
No.
The people that were advocating healthcare first were not wrong that every day that you didn't do it is a day you probably can't get it done. Those of us who are arguing for taking on the financial industry and making the banks and insurance companies your enemy, we're right both on the economics, but more importantly, right also on the politics, which is you needed an enemy of an interest group the American people were angry at. Mm-hmm. In the end of the day, he got 300 plus electoral votes. He makes the big decision. He picked health care. We did get health care, but there was a political cost called the Tea Party. And none of these are 100% right and zero wrong. I do believe that we should have taken on the fight. After both TARP, the bailout for the banks and insurance companies, and then after the Recovery Act of $1.6 trillion collectively, and that's when $1.6 trillion was real money. The culture of the country needed a Old Testament justice. And you can't do, you couldn't do both. And the president said of the three kids, cap and trade, healthcare, and financial reform, his favorite child was healthcare. That was his joke that Saturday.
Yeah.
And he wasn't wrong. We got it done, but don't think that it doesn't come with a consequence, both in the sense of—
It's a trade-off, yeah.
Because to pass healthcare, the insurance companies had to sit on the same table. That was the lesson from Hillary Care. Fighting banks would have been a better fight. That said, healthcare has become the kind of the beaches of Okinawa for the Republican Party.
Yeah, that's right. I want to ask you one kind of L.A. question before we get to foreign policy. Yeah, you're in L.A. at the moment. I think you got a relative who works in the movie business. I think he's like a PA or something.
I try to forget that he's my brother.
So what do you make of this battle between Paramount and Netflix to buy Warner Brothers, and in particular, like President Trump's efforts to inject himself into the process and pick the winner? Like, I'm imagining 2010 Barack Obama calling up Warner Brothers and saying, like, you must greenlight The Town 2.
Okay, let me wait, but before we get to this, Tom, how many times a day do you say to yourself, if we had done something?
Every day.
Okay, 10 times like a day, before 10 times before 9 a.m.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't believe I spent $300,000 creating a blind trust as chief executive. I mean, as chief of staff. I can't believe I did that.
Yeah.
And I look at this, and also another couple hundred for ambassador. I look at people coming out of prison already nominated. I'm like, what? What am I, the schmuck in the room?
We all were
one
schmucks.
Funny story. I give the head of the ethics at the State Department, you know, 4 months out, you have to do an exit ethics report. I said, I will do this, but you must be the Maytag woman, Matt. I mean, is nobody filling out? I look at all these people who've never filled out a financial form. You're chasing me 4 months afterwards?
It's crazy.
Yeah. Okay. Now that thanks for the third bit. Let me go where I think the problem is. This is the Roberts Supreme Court. I blame them. Because with their decisions about FTC, the Securities and Exchange, that their view of the unitary power of the presidency means that the president is the ultimate judge. And he will insert himself, and it won't be the rule of law, and it won't be a non-political independent body.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody believes this Justin Department antitrust division.
No.
Okay? So Noah Feldman in Bloomberg had a fabulous piece yesterday that all the other justices at the Court of Appeal, you know, Circuit Court, Court of Appeals, et cetera, have done a fabulous job, and the Supreme Court, the leaders, have abandoned the rank and file judges on the field. This is their fault. I'm not a fan of Trump, so I don't want this to be... He has a permission slip to insert himself. And all the guardrails about concentrating power in either one person or one of the three branches of government have been eradicated. Forget the Congress, because the Republicans have put their entire manhood into a lockbox. This is Roberts' fault, and nobody should kid themselves. The Supreme Court has made a horrendous decision about the balance of power in a country that's based on the rule of law, and you got a decision here, and the president's inserting himself not only against CNN and not only on what he's rewarding friends that have rewarded him, and he's going to weigh in.
Yeah,
this is not a pop quiz. You forget that you and I mean, whatever I feel about Donald Trump, you have given the president, whoever he or she may be, a permission slip to have an opinion that's more powerful than the law. This is for originalists or a court system that thinks of themselves as originalists. This is not anywhere close to the original founding framers of the Constitution about how power exercises itself in a political system.
I agree. It's crazy.
I've read about Netflix versus Paramount and the concentration. I don't know. But what I do know is that the Supreme Court has allowed the opinion of a president to outweigh the law in a dramatic way. And I'm putting aside Donald Trump. There will be another decision of a concentration of power, economic. And the Supreme Court has given a green light to whoever's in the presidency to make that decision, not the laws and the interests of the country. And we do have two problems. I think of myself as a free market capitalist. And on one side, you have Marxism. On the other side, you have monopolists. And right now, the monopolists are winning because that's Donald Trump's economic philosophy.
Yeah.
And he gets to decide, because he's also going to, like he's doing today, and I've talked about this a year ago on Ezra Klein Show, corruption is going to be the issue. And I actually think the reason MAGA voters feel the way they do is because they've betrayed. Rather than worried about their paycheck and their checkbook, he's worried about his paycheck and his checkbook, and they know it.
Yeah, I think you're right. Look, I think point well taken on the courts. I also do blame Amazon a little bit for paying $40 million for some boring-ass Melania documentary, which is self-evidently a bribe.
Yeah.
But, you know, whatever.
In broad daylight.
We'll call it what it is, I guess.
No, I mean, look.
No accountability.
This is, and I'm going to do a shout-out to the American people. The Roberts Court is corrupt. Corporate America is spineless. Republicans in Congress and the both branches are useless. So we're down to the judgment of the American people, and thank God for them. I know a lot of people in our party, oh, the American people, why do they vote for this guy? They are going to issue a judgment in 2026. And I'm very confident, unless something dramatic happens, it is going to be a verdict of guilty on the president of the Republican Party. And thank God for them, because they are the thin blue line that's going to put a stop to Donald Trump and pause it. Where Roberts, the Republicans, corporate leaders, titans of media are useless.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to make sure that this gets through the FCC, what I'm saying, because they are useless. And I could say some other things I used to say when I was chief of staff and you walked in. I cannot stand what they have done.
Yeah, I agree.
Every one of them have failed the test of integrity.
Pod Save America is brought to you by AG1. AG1 is the daily health drink that combines your multivitamin, pre and probiotics, superfoods, and antioxidants into one simple green scoop. It's one of the easiest things you can do to support your body every day. This time of the year, with the chaos of the holiday season, it's more important than ever to be proactive about supporting your immune health, especially if you have kids, because they're all getting sick, and all their friends are sick, and all their friends' friends are sick, and then everybody's sick.
So true.
With AG1, you can be confident you're giving your immune system the daily support it needs to power through the hectic schedules. We all know it can be hard to maintain a balanced diet and give your body the nutrition it needs during the holiday season. AG1 Next Gen contains more vitamins and minerals than ever before, and it's clinically shown to fill common nutrient gaps. The pro and prebiotics in AG1 also help support your gut health and digestion. If you need a little help winding down at night from all the holiday festivities, try AGZ, the new nighttime drink designed to support restful, restorative sleep. Look, I love AG1. I find it to be particularly great in the morning. You just put a scoop right into your smoothie or whatever, water if you don't have smoothies. It tastes good. It adds a little, you know, kind of like a light apple flavor to the... You know, that was always my takeaway. A little nice, like, kind of sweetness. I don't know. It really helps. It works. You get a lot of nutrition, and what's the problem? As we approach the new year, it's never too early to take control of your health. AG1 is the easiest daily health habits that you can start even before the new year. AG1 is their best offer ever. If you head to drinkag1.com/crooked, you'll get the welcome kit, a morning person hat, a year's supply of vitamin D plus K2, an AG1 flavor sampler, and you'll get to try their new sleep supplement, AGZ, for free, which has been a game changer for my nightly routine. That's $126 in free gifts for new subscribers. That's drinkag1.com/crooked.
Hey, Crooked listeners. If you haven't become a friend of the pod yet, you are missing out on exclusive bonus content that drops every single week. If you do join, you're helping us, grow Crooked Media, which is one of the few independent, proudly pro-democracy media companies left in Trump's America. If you join, you also get ad-free episodes of all your favorite pods, ad-free episodes of Pod Save America, Love It or Leave It, Offline, Pod Save the World. You also get bonus content like our new extra episode of Pod Save America called Pod Save America Only Friends, Dan Pfeiffer's Polar Coaster. You also get access to all of our excellent Substack newsletters like Pod Save America Open Tabs and tons more great content. So, stop what you're doing right now and go ahead and subscribe at crooked.com/friends. Check it out.
All right. So when we talked about setting this up, you wanted to do some foreign policy, which was music to my ears.
I'm a foreign policy person.
You're an expert. You're an expert. Honestly.
I actually may one day get a double-breasted suit.
There we go. Yeah. Work at Foggy Bottom. In the wake of the war in Gaza... on October 7th, a lot of Democrats have been saying we need to rethink U.S. policy towards Israel. Our friend and former colleague Ben Rhodes wrote this piece in the New York Times a couple weeks back. He recommended, among other things, that the U.S. cut off military support to Israel, support U.S. recognition of a Palestinian state, and refuse to take AIPAC money. Mm-hmm. Curious what you think of those recommendations, and then like what changes you would propose, if any.
So, as you, Tommy, you know this. In 2009, there's only one person the prime minister of Israel calls a self-hating Jew publicly.
You and Axelrod, right?
Yeah, Axelrod's pissed that he never gets the recognition. I said, you're not that good a Jew, David. You're also not named Rahm Israel Emanuel.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, publicly, and he's also in his book, the only person he attacks in the book is me. His own book, BBC.
What did he attack you for?
Like just that I was anti-Israel, you know, the same stuff.
Got it.
And if you remember, and I think you do, that battle, also in the Oval Office, where literally the president had to tell the prime minister, I'm the president, lay off of Rahm, and so on and so forth. I have a photo of it, actually, because we went toe-to-toe over the housing expansions and settlements expansion in West Bank.
Yeah.
So here's, let me, before it's just about Israel, let's talk about the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And I'll talk about Israel in that context because I think it's the context that matters. Israel has never been more strategically secure since Ben-Gurion was dancing the Hora in 1948 in Tel Aviv, but more politically vulnerable. Hmm. I had never in my life that I thought that a prime minister of the state of Israel would lead Jews back into the ghetto. And that's what's happening in Israel, that's what's happening in the world, and that's what's happening around the world. Jews can't go to Europe and participate in Eurovision, while the UAE is holding, hosting the world financially in the F1. He has literally, in the way he has executed pieces of the last, not just the last 2 years, but over his time, isolated Jews in Israel. The fact of the matter is, this is the best strategic terrain Israel's had since the founding. You have peace in Jordan with Israel. You have peace with Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
Syria and Lebanon basically call it non-belligerence. You can use whatever label, but it is in more secure place than ever before. Iran is on their back foot. I do want to spend time on this because I think one of the most unreported stories right now is the collapse of Iran, not just strategically, imploding in society. You don't really have in the near geography a strategic threat. Second, when we were starting in politics, the Gulf was all about just oil. Today, they want to be part of the world economy, which is what Israel's ace is. The UAE, Bahrain, Oman, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia want to use their petrodollars to be part of the global economy and their citizens to be part of the global economy. That is an invitation for Israel. And they're pissing it away with this prime minister. Rabin understood that, and he was a statesman, and I say because we're on the 30-year eve of his assassination, to seize a moment. It's, look, these are not easy decisions. You have to make compromises and then kind of leap into the strategic, not only unknown, but try to shape the events to your favor. You have the Gulf countries ready to accept Israel as part of the region, which has been the dream, the nation among nations since its founding. And B, you have strategic stability and you have you are perceived as a strategic superpower in the region. That is and an economic superpower. That is an incredible, that is as good a chessboard as Israel has ever had in 77 years. And there is nothing that this prime minister has done, whether it's with Lebanon, Syria, or the situations they have done that opened up the Gulf, to seize that moment that the IDF created. Now, I would do things that are very clear as it relates to Israel. You've crossed the line on the settlements, unacceptable. I said this when I was ambassador to Japan to members of the Biden administration. Any settler who's involved in any violence on the West Bank is on a no-fly zone.
Hmm.
Put them on a no-fly zone. Nothing would make them more upset that they can't come go to Brooklyn, go to any part of America, or go to Europe. Just no fly zone.
Biden sort of started some of that process, but Trump walked it back, right? You want to go further. Okay.
Without calling it out, there are people that know that I want to go much further.
Got it.
Two, you know, and you and I worked on this. President Obama signed the largest security defense package in Israel's history. I would continue that, but there are going to be restraints and boundaries on that.
And third, you're either going to make the most of this strategic opportunity, but you will not hold America's foreign policy. You will not hold our strategic interests. I think all the others in Trump administration that basically want to just be a hemispheric, you do not want to give up our position in the Middle East. I think that's a foolish idea and strategically flawed. And I would say this is where we're going, and you can either be a part of it or you can be on your own. So if you want, Mr. Prime Minister, you want a Sparta nation, let me not stop you. But you're going to realize that's a losing bet.
Well, but a lot of people sort of default to the two-state solution, right? But Netanyahu says he opposes a Palestinian state. The Knesset just voted to annex the West Bank. We've been dealing with this right-wing government in Israel for 15 years. It's only getting worse. It's like, you know, Ben-Gavir and Bezalel Smotrich are now like extremists who are members. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Authority has no credibility. It's been undercut.
They don't get a pass because they missed three from Camp David with Ehud Barak and Yasser Arafat to what Olmert offered him 6 years later. It's all the same, but they have missed many opportunities, and Israel has, since those times and other events in, you know, from bombs in Dizengoff Square to October 7th, have just legitimized their position of non-dialogue, but it's not a choice.
Right. And so, like, I guess what I'm getting at is, it feels like, look, a lot of Democrats in the U.S. just say, oh, we need a two-state solution, we need to negotiate. It feels like that's just a way to punt and we'll perpetuate the status quo. At some point, don't we need to use our leverage where we can to try to push or pressure Netanyahu into making better decisions?
Well, here's the one thing, and since Netanyahu's decided to play in American politics, I have no problem discussing, but the first step on that journey, and I give Naftali Ben-David, the former prime minister, that was kind of the one prime minister interrupting Bibi's 17-year run, is legitimizing the Arab Israelis to be part of the coalition government. They were, they had 10 seats. That would reduce the stigma, but also legitimize the Arab participation. I mean, 1/3 of the pop, not 1/3, 20% of the population is Arab Israelis. That's first step. Second, there are boundaries. And this was also part of the housing fight that, I mean, Mitchell and I were not on the same page. He thought I was too strident about this. At that time, I haven't seen the law since. You used to be able in America to get a tax write-off if you contribute to building settlements in Israel. Eliminate it. I don't know if it has been eliminated, but back then it wasn't. That was my position. Two, you cross the line. Totally unacceptable. Three, you're part of any violence. You're on a no-fly zone. You have to impose political, not just economic, but there are some economic costs to violating the two-state solution. Because, look, there will never be a river to the sea, and there will never be a greater Israel, which is the inverse of the river to the sea. They're the same thing. Both parties have to give up their extremist position and learn how to live together. There is a legitimate concern by Israel in the sense of a Palestinian Authority that can be a legitimate partner with the interest of finding how to work with the State of Israel. You and I sit here in Beverly Hills as we're taping this.
Hollywood, sure.
Okay, Hollywood. The trauma on Israel post-October 7th.
Horrifying. Unimaginable.
It took us a decade on September 11th.
Yes.
And you can't...
No doubt.
If you're navigating a democracy, you can't basically ignore that trauma.
I agree.
And it's real. It's viscerally real.
I agree.
Finding up, and there's a sad twist of irony, because the kibbutzim on the border of Gaza, when you look at the vote totals, were the most progressive in Israel politics.
The most,
and they destroyed, not just Hamas, but the attacks in Dizengoff going back 20 years ago, destroyed any center of gravity in Israel for finding a partner for peace. That's just a fact for their psyche and their dynamics of their politics. The history of America with Israel is America does things to create a space for a prime minister to take the risky political steps. Coddling prime minister, saying yes to his actions, is not in Israel's self-interest. That has not worked, and this course will not work. You will not repress the Palestinian aspiration for a state. on the other hand, the Palestinians have to accept a two-state solution, not a river-to-the-sea solution.
But would you want to condition military aid so that it's not used in the West Bank, for example? Like, you know, you've seen the videos I've seen of Smotrich handing out American machine guns to extremists in the West Bank. Like, shouldn't there be some strings attached to that money?
A small why, yes. As it relates to the West Bank, et cetera, I get what you're saying. As it relates to the security of Israel and in the relationship, because the biggest conflict right now in Israel is Gaza. It's not kind of Iran, although Iran's a very serious threat, but I'm saying in the sense of hot or Lebanon. So there's got to, there, without going this policy, there has to be a cost benefit to making sure that Israel realizes the decisions they make to continually repress a Palestinian aspiration to, and we're paying for it. America's paying for it. And I think Israel's paying for it by through their isolation, both political, strategic, and economically. I mean, look, the Israeli Symphony can't go perform somewhere in Europe, and a singer can't perform somewhere in Europe. People, academics can't participate in conferences on biomedicine, and some of the great biomedicines and life sciences are being done in Israel, or in AI technology. That isolation is going to come with a consequence. And forget that I said it. I'd like to remind the prime minister, Israel's now facing, for the first time, a net emigration. Your best young minds in the areas of science and technology are leaving, and they're going to Berlin, which has its own twist of irony. I said, yeah, you want to keep doing this, go ahead, because we're not going to bankroll this, because you're bankrupting your own country. And you have to be, nothing helps, as somebody who took on Bibi in 2009, when a lot of other people were lip-syncing the talking points out of AIPAC. Nothing helps Israel by saying yes to them automatically. There's a cost to this, and we can't keep covering up that cost. So whether your manifestation of is it restrictions on weapons, I'm finding a series of other things that I think would hit a nerve politically and culturally in Israel, that this is not the cost we should be paying. This is not the Rubicon. I'm not disagreeing with you.
No, no. Sorry.
The question is, which of these restrictions, costs, would hit the nerve to get them to wake up? Because right now they're living in an illusion that there is no choice they have to make. The choice you're making, which you think is no choice, comes at a huge consequence, and I'm not covering that bill for you when I say I, meaning the Americans anymore.
Agreed with that. Last little thing on this.
Meaning, so, because we're doing things. If you want to isolate Israel, and you, Mr. Prime Minister, give this stupid speech about Sparta, that's you. We're not going to isolate ourselves. And what you're doing, we're not going to keep covering it, because we're not going to get isolated with you.
Yeah.
That's not how we're doing this score.
Yeah. Last little thing on this. So speaking of Ben
quote
Rhodes.
President Clinton, who is the superpower
here?
Who's
the fucking superpower here, Netanyahu? We're going to take a quick break. But before we do, please listen for 30 more seconds. That's your gift to me this holiday season. If you like Crooked Media, if you want to support the work we're doing, please consider becoming a subscriber. Go to crooked.com/friends. It's the best way you could support what we're doing here. You also get tons of great bonus content like Polar Coaster from Dan Pfeiffer, where he digs deep into all the polls. He's doing an end of the year wrap up and looking at what all the data might mean going into Trump's lame duck 2026 midterm year. There's also lots of fun shows like Termly Online. There's bonus behind the scenes stuff. You get lots of great content, including ad-free episodes of your favorite Crooked shows, but also it really helps us as an organization. So crooked.com/friends.
Pod Save America is brought to you by Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Please don't skip this ad. I know you might be tempted, but this really matters. Planned Parenthood is on the front lines every day, defending our rights when healthcare is under attack. And right now, they need us. Here's why. The Trump administration and Congress have defunded Planned Parenthood. It's a devastating blow to patients and our country's already broken healthcare system. Planned Parenthood health centers are committed to providing care no matter what, but they need your help to do it. Whether you give a little or a lot, your gift says something about who you are. Someone who shows up for what's right, who believes people who need care should be able to get it. Please don't wait. Go to PlannedParenthood.org/defend and give today. That's PlannedParenthood.org/defend. Hey, Crooked listeners. If you haven't become a friend of the pod yet, you are missing out on exclusive bonus content that drops every single week. If you do join, you're helping us, grow Crooked Media, which is one of the few independent, proudly pro-democracy media companies left in Trump's America. If you join, you also get ad-free episodes of all your favorite pods, ad-free episodes of Pod Save America, Love It or Leave It, Offline, Pod Save the World. You also get bonus content like our new extra episode of Pod Save America called Pod Save America Only Friends, Dan Pfeiffer's Polar Coaster. You also get access to all of our excellent Substack newsletters like Pod Save America Open Tabs and tons more great content. So stop what you're doing right now and go ahead and subscribe at crooked.com/friends. Check it out.
Ben Rhodes wrote in his book that you once jokingly referred to him as Hamas. People on the left have taken this anecdote and interpreted it as showing that you didn't care about Palestinian rights. People on the right seem to think, they like to throw it in Ben's face and suggest you think he was a literal terrorist sympathizer. Do you want to clarify whether in that moment you thought Ben was living in a tunnel somewhere?
No, I still think academia is a tunnel. No, as I, well, first of all, you are talking about John Kerry as chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee. Calls, the president's on the road. He says, Hamas wants to hand me a letter. I said, well, take it. Fact.
Yeah.
I said, bring it back so we can see it. I said, don't cut off and the communication. And as soon as the president was back, it was a domestic trip. I said, I approve this. And he says, good. So that's my background. I don't remember that anecdote, but sounds kind of accurate. So it's hard for me to argue about it.
Sounds like
but
harmless joke. To
no, well, yeah, it was probably harmless, but it obviously it cut a nerve with Ben because he remembers it. But hey, look, we had disagreements, which is what you're supposed to have on policy and how best to, the goal of what we were both trying to achieve, and I don't mean just isolating this to Ben and I, it's ironic. Ben would say what he said about me and then Bibi would say what I said, I think I'm perfectly positioned.
you mentioned Iran a couple times. Do you think President Trump was right to bomb Iran's nuclear sites?
The decision, yes, but let me walk back where I think we are. One is we made this threat by all means. Both Democrat Republican presidents have said all options are on the table.
Right.
Here was an option and you had a chance for once in a because if you didn't do it, you definitely would have been shorter than where we are from a strategic setback. I actually think one of the things, Tommy, that's underappreciated right now, and you have a lot of news around Ukraine, you have what China's doing vis-a-vis Japan and or Taiwan right now. I think this split between society and the government in Iran is an underappreciated, underreported story. I don't think 3 years from now, Iran's going to be what you and I are sitting here today. There's a massive drought where they're talking about moving the capital out of Tehran.
Huge drought.
I don't know if anybody knows this, but that's not a minor story.
Yeah.
Two, there are bars popping up all over the place, and the government can't and won't and will not shut them down. Women now are fully dressing and doing whatever they want as it relates to the hijab law that we talk about, but from cosmetics, etc. Fourth, music concerts that were restricted are happening all over the place. Fifth, there was recently a marathon run in which women were dressing like as if they were any Western city. There is a gulf of legitimacy between the society and the government that is wider than we've ever experienced. Now, a lot of people have said the revolution or the collapse of the government is right around the corner, so that I could also be the 20th wrong predictor. Mm-hmm. But in the last dozen years, you've had three separate manifestations of domestic civil unrest. Something is bubbling. You've also had the economic pressure by the West led by the United States. And you have, given that the government and most importantly the security apparatus failed in its ability to protect the country, I think the religious, and you have, lastly, I should just say, a head of state who's 80 plus years old, too old, and there's a transition of power. All those data points always, historically, but in this point to something dramatically about to happen.
Something breaking.
Yeah, and I don't know, it doesn't mean that it goes reformist. And I should probably add, the president of Iran just said, I can't fix this.
Yeah, that was a weird quote.
That was, yeah, that we would, you and I would have grabbed
sure
President
that would go
Obama
well, yeah.
by the collar, pulled yeah. him back into the. Oh, well, we're not saying that. That's a, no. I don't know what happened with the truth medication, but we're changing the dosage here. no, I think so. What something is, something's not good in Denmark. To quote William Shakespeare, so something is amiss there, and it's not on anybody's radar screen as like the last proposal between the Russians and Ukrainians for good reason, but something long, short and medium term is happening there of massive significance where the relationship between society and government is under a fundamental change. Does it lead to revolution? I don't know. But when you have that transition of power, there's going to be a break. That's my prediction.
So just on the Iranian front.
You think, I mean, do you think that's a wrong analysis?
No, I think it's an interesting analysis. I'm watching as closely as you are. I just think on the nuclear front, I mean, you know, the tail of the tape is, you're right, everyone, every Democrat, Obama included, Republican said, all options are on the table. Then Obama cuts the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. Yeah. The U.S. pulls out of it unilaterally, even mm-hmm. though the Iranians are complying. Mm-hmm. His own staff, his national security team is like, don't do this. Yeah. This is making us safer. Then he gets into these talks with the Iranians, you know, sort of this iteration, this last year. He says he wants to cut a deal, mm-hmm. but now the Trump administration is like bragging to the press about how they were actually lying and they were just saying they wanted more talks to, you know, give the Israelis covers mm-hmm. to go bomb the shit
well,
out
that
of them.
Is,
and that we
that's
bombed.
Crazy, yeah.
And I just worry about American credibility because who's going to cut a deal with
well,
us?
Well, here's the thing, though. So let's take the credibility and thread it. I happen to think when President Obama said to Syria that you're going to cross a red line and we didn't execute on that, it hurt America's credibility. You have a situation where Israel's bombing what they're doing, et cetera. We always have said all options on the table. Had we not chosen to do that, I think American credibility would have taken a hit. I'm not wrong about, look, I supported the agreement with Iran. It's a 51-49, but I leaned on the 51. Mm-hmm. It was not a 80-20, it wasn't a 60-40. That's just my view. It was a close call. It was a bet that if you stymied the nuclear piece, that this thing that I'm talking about that's happening now, because of the demographics of Iran, the youth who wanted to be part of the world would desire. Mm-hmm. That was the basic bet. Now, what it didn't do was deal with the Shiite crescent from Hezbollah to Syria, et cetera. And what it didn't do was deal with the technology on missile delivery, which are faults to that agreement. There were blemishes on that agreement.
They were part of it, right?
I mean, look, every
agreement.
Can't
do everything.
Yeah. As I don't know if you know this, but the Obamacare didn't do everything on healthcare.
Exactly, right. Yeah,
you just basically, you make a decision that this slice of the loaf of the bread is good, if not good enough.
Yeah.
Okay? And that, those were two things that were big problems. You had to make a decision, were they problems enough not to do it? And that's why I say the president was right to do it, but I'm conscious of it. It's a 51-49 call. That was his option on the table, but he always said to get there, the military kinetic option had to be there. There was a chance, given that what Iran was doing in the final 3 months prior to that, of not participating in the international community and not really opening up the full kimono, you could set back their nuclear timeline. And so, again, that too, the bombing was a 51-49 decision. If you ask me, I think it was the right decision.
I'm just worried we're going to be doing it again pretty soon, but, you know, we'll see.
I do, that's actually, the two things I'd keep a flashing light as Gaza stalls and Israel gets filled with their hubris, specifically the prime minister, and not have the courage to make the most of this strategic window he has that the IDF gave him. I worry about his decision, what he's going to do with Hezbollah up in Lebanon, and what he's going to do that he thinks that he has an opportunity to continue to keep Iran on their back heel. That, and I do worry about that.
Yeah.
That's why I think America's power is not to say us closely aligned, but here is our position. And anytime you're going to endanger our strategic position, that's when we have a gulf between us. It's not our job to stay close to you. It's your job to stay close to us.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going super long, so you tell me when you got to go.
I got to catch a flight. What time is it?
10:56.
Okay, you get like, we're going to do No more than 10 minutes, but five
okay,
minutes.
Great.
Okay.
All right. So
Fast round. Let's go. Globe.
So you were Biden's ambassador to Japan.
Rumor has it. You're still an ally.
You're still an ally.
You had doubts, Tommy. You did not think that it could go 3 years, let alone 3 months as an ally.
God bless you. There's a lot of turnover over there. Didn't notice that. So they have a new prime minister, Sanae Takaichi. Mm. She's the first woman to serve as prime minister. Yeah. Interesting person, ultra-conservative, kind of wonky nationalist, like Shinzo Abe protege. But she made waves right out of the gate by saying that if the Chinese invade Taiwan, that is a, like a so-called existential threat, which would allow Japan under their constitution to deploy troops and use force. That didn't go over well in Beijing. They led to this war of words, diplomatic crisis. And then earlier this month, Tokyo says Chinese fighter jets locked radar on their F-15s for like 30 minutes.
And it took the United States 10 days, 2 weeks to say to the long pole, our most trusted ally, that we're going to stand behind you.
Which is
crazy. With a B-52 and some exercises.
Which is crazy.
Yes.
And I'm wondering...
And everybody in the rest of the region was watching the United States fumble the ball.
Well, so that's sort of the bigger point. Like, first of all, was this a rookie move on her part? How did you read what she said? And also, how worried are we that we got, like, rising China, increasingly nationalist and militarized Japan... And then the U.S., who seemed willing to just, like, sell out Taiwan and walk away if we can get an economic deal from the Chinese.
Yeah. I don't know. You just saw the military package by the president.
That was
pretty robust on the check.
From Congress, right?
It did go $11 billion. It was kind of robust.
Yeah, it was
you might be right. I thought it was announced by the administration. Maybe I'm
wrong. I could be wrong.
So let's go on the core here. I don't think her move was rookie. She actually enunciated... what had been the policy, and I actually think what China's upset is now it's explicit. What China never wanted was the cost to be explicit. And it isolated China in the region. My constant refrain when I was in the administration, and I think we were there, not that I shaped it, but I influenced it, which was our goal is to isolate the isolator. China's strategy is to constantly take one country, use political, economic, and other type of power to isolate them.
Crush them.
But by building the coalition of Australia, South Korea, Japan, the Philippines, India, Canada, that China's the isolator. And they knew it. That's why. So I think what she did is the right. She said what was always implied, never clear. And now China knows the cost. Second, they're doing a series of things on the island chains of Okinawa that go all the way to within 67 miles of Taiwan, that things that we worked on that I thought would take a decade are happening. Third, my guess is what she is doing helps him at home, and what she's doing is helping her at home politically because she's in the 70s. As I said, she's the only head of state in the entire developed world that's above 50%, and that's a telling sign. And I think she's done a unique thing as a woman. She's gotten the urban centers of Japan excited about this change. On the other hand, her policies are all very old and traditional and conservative, so she's kept the LDP's rural base and brought them back into the fold when they were fading away. So she's got this kind of very interesting, solid position based on the fact that both by person and by policy, she's put together a coalition that the LDP has been struggling for 20 years to get politically. Third, you know, Japan is the long pole of America's policy in Indo-Pacific.
Yeah, a lot of troops.
And for her to say, one, they went up under our watch from 1% to 2% of GDP to defense spending, from the ninth to the third largest capabilities. They just did something recently that everybody would have said you couldn't do without a constitutional change. They're selling military equipment to Australia. That used to be banned. So they are crossing thresholds because of the security threat. Now, if the United States was all in giving confidence to our allies, Korea, Japan, Australia, not doing what we did in India, which is ridiculous, we have a partner now for a robust strategy that would say to China, here are the costs for what you're going to do. And you better think about this. And remember one other thing. China's, in my view, first strategy vis-a-vis Taiwan is going to be more of a kind of quarantine.
Yeah, we'll blockade.
You cannot do that given where we are in the Philippines and where Japan is on the southern islands of Okinawa that come part of that first island chain. It is not impossible, but very difficult once those capacities are fully mobilized. And so to me, to short end of your comments is, I think that it wasn't a rookie mistake. And I think it's incumbent upon us not to make her look like she has to back down to China, because that will not stay in the Japan periphery. That will reverberate in the region. And if we look like we're weak, and we look like we're not a permanent Pacific power and presence, there is no way that countries in that region, and I'm thinking of Korea and Japan, don't think over the next 10 years that they have to go nuclear.
Yeah.
If you think the cost of nonproliferation is expensive, you're going to get sticker shock on proliferation.
No shit. Yeah. No. It's real scary. Last question. Got to get to a flight.
Up. Yeah.
I've been thinking a lot about like early Obama era counterterrorism policies. A lot of critics say there are way too many drone strikes. The further I get from that time in government, I tend to agree with them.
Really?
And well, I tend to feel like the so-called, you know, war on terror writ large has been an abject failure when you see Al-Qaeda-like affiliates, ISIS spreading everywhere, right? Now, the counterpoint to that is, when you were chief of staff, 2009, 2010, there were some real deal, scary threats to the United States. You know, the Christmas Day bomber, Times Square bomber.
The guy from Colorado. I'll walk you through that story.
Najib El-Azazi, right? That's right.
That, I'll never forget. Like, yes.
Near misses. Like, we luck saved us from catastrophe, right? And then there were these counterterrorism policies, and a lot of those things haven't happened again. So I'm just curious, when you reflect on that time and you think about how you'd keep the country safe from terrorism, how that informs your thinking.
You know, I've always, so I don't know if you remember this story. Some young man in the NSA picked up a word on the telecommunications that said the marriage worked. And he just caught him and says, nobody says that. And then he starts to unravel this. And where the call was originated and made. Now, all the smarty pants poo-pooed this kid. Well, I said, and I, not just me, but the president, myself, you know, Biden, well, run it down. Turns out, they find out, he goes to Walmart and buys 10 backpacks. He goes to one of those kind of bulk buying, you know, when you buy stuff for the beauty show, all these giant cases that are essential materials for homemade bombs. And then all the smarty pants who thought the kid was out of his mind because he caught the word, the marriage worked. That's what you say after 20 years, not in 10 seconds. That he was onto something. Then we started finding other stuff in his credit card. And then we put helicopters and we find out he's starting to drive.
To New York, right?
To New York.
Yeah.
And we had cars to New Jersey. So I'll never forget that. 96 hours. I must have aged, and I think the president did too, and we aged, although we had confidence we had them, in the sense we had them in our sight, line of vision. But that was breathtaking, and there were other events that you have identified.
This guy named Najib El-Azazi, who along with two friends was going to blow up the New York City
and
subway.
I don't know if you remember, but the FBI got ahead of the police department. The police department moved ahead. And it is classic case of the FBI and local law enforcement not exactly being on the same page. But that said, got him before anything. And the imam, no, it's not clear whether he knew it or was protecting him or was acting like he didn't know him, et cetera, or what his intent was. So to me, I hadn't really thought about it in the sense, did our actions have a reaction that made the situation worse? I do think you have to think about two things. One, people are trying to do harm to the United States. Our border, specifically on the South, have been used by enemies for their advantage. And you have to be, that doesn't, Donald Trump pulling people's green cards, not letting kids go to school, that's not the end. That's
right. It's crazy.
But I haven't thought a lot recently about whether the policies we were pursuing in the quote unquote, in the name of the war on terror, both overseas and here, actually perpetuated or accentuated, because I think actually on one scorecard, we haven't really had a local terrorism attack vis-a-vis kind of a 9/11 like.
Yeah.
So at one level, from a homeland front, it has worked. Whether it has created its own, the terrorist cells, there's as many before, there's just more of them spread out and smaller. That just may be what both of those are happening in real time, which is we've protected the home front, but we've created more threats overseas.
Yeah, it's a complicated story.
Yeah.
Rahm Emanuel, thank you so much for sitting down.
Yeah, thank
you. Appreciate it. Great to see you. Could ask you another hour. But
happy and a healthy new year.
You
and
too.
And mazel tov to you and your wife and the young kids.
Thank you.
If you want to listen to Pod Save America ad-free and get access to exclusive podcasts, go to cricket.com/friends to subscribe on Supercast, Substack, YouTube, or Apple Podcasts. Also, please consider leaving us a review. That helps boost this episode and everything we do here at Cricket. Pod Save America is a Cricket Media production. Our producers are David Toledo, Emma Illick-Frank, and Saul Rubin. Our associate producer is Farah Safari. Austin Fisher is our senior producer. Reed Cherlin is our executive editor. Adrian Hill is our head of news and politics. The show is mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Jordan Cantor is our sound engineer, with audio support from Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Matt DeGroat is our head of production. Naomi Sengel is our executive assistant. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Haley Jones, Ben Hefcoat, Mia Kelman, Kirill Pelaviv, David Tolles, and Ryan Young. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East. Hey, Crooked listeners, if you haven't become a friend of the pod yet, you are missing out on exclusive bonus content that drops every single week. If you do join, you're helping us, grow Crooked Media, which is one of the few independent, proudly pro-democracy media companies left in Trump's America. If you join, you also get ad-free episodes of all your favorite pods, ad-free episodes of Pod Save America, Love It or Leave It, Offline, Pod Save the World. You also get bonus content like our new extra episode of Pod Save America called Pod Save America Only Friends, Dan Pfeiffer's Polar Coaster. You also get access to all of our excellent Substack newsletters like Pod Save America Open Tabs and tons more great content. So stop what you're doing right now and go ahead and subscribe at cricket.com/friends. Check it out.
What do one of the world's top food cities, a nationally celebrated zoo and science museum, and a Condé Nast Traveler Top 10 Best Big City in the Country have in common? Yes, it's Columbus. This isn't just a stop on the map. It's where award-winning flavors, unforgettable family moments, and big city buzz come together. Let's be honest, Columbus is turning heads. For top-of-the-line discoveries in your own backyard, visit experiencecolumbus.com/summer.
What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear: strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/ohio's time.